You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for December 4th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live on the first day of Gunnica, that brief interval between American mass shootings. It's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Gunnica doesn't even last a day anymore. We're not being funny.
No, we're not trying to be funny. This is the day after the massacre in San Bernardino.
Well, and the Planned Parenthood shooting happened since the last podcast as well. So,
and a bunch of people have pointed out mass shootings.
This year,
there have been days in this year.
Yep.
So,
today the U.S. Senate is unveiling a bust of Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
So we're going to get into all of this. If you don't mind, I'm going to start by just reading the few sentences I wrote on Facebook when the announcement was made about the Dick Cheney bust.
Yes.
I wrote a few sentences on Facebook just to remind everyone.
I've heard of Facebook,
As president of the Senate, Dick Cheney broke the tie vote and passed the Bush tax cuts. More than any other person on earth, he is responsible for turning the Clinton surplus into today's deficits. And don't get me started about the $23 million he personally made in profit in 1 year, 2003, as sitting vice president, from stock gains resulting from the Iraq war he sold to the American media. He then paid an artificially low tax rate on those capital gains because he voted those rates in. Conflict of interest on parade, corruption personified, and a true war monger. In the literal sense, of course the GOP Congress will give him a statue in between Benghazi and Planned Parenthood hearings.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I want to talk about these shootings in a religious sense and in a political sense, because it's interesting that religion and politics have both come up in the past day or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a perfect storm to dovetail with corruption and just how much the NRA owns our politicians.
Yep.
And that is a real conflagration, and I mean that in the fire sense of the lit match of political corruption and being able to buy congressional seats with money and super PACs.
Yep.
The ability to then influence legislation, especially at the state house level, so that gun manufacturers are never held responsible. And actually, there's a wonderful article at Think Progress about how ALEC and the NRA worked together. They learned all the lessons they needed to know from the tobacco settlement on how to avoid any responsibility for killing people.
Yep. They do learn. Here's the thing.
Yep.
For a group of people who swear the past never happened, they learn from it really efficiently.
When it's going to make them money, they do.
Yeah.
What they want. Yeah.
The libertarian – I don't want to take you off track, but I do want to add that all the libertarian think tanks, the Heartland Alliance, for example, that Ben Dominic works for, that does climate change denial for a living, learned chapter and verse how to sell fake science. Or how to delay action from the good old days when they were taking money from the tobacco industry.
Because
first you say the science is false, and then you say the science is mixed. He said, she said.
It's controversial.
And then you point out that the people on the other side are taking money for doing science, and therefore they really can't be trusted. And then when the science becomes overwhelmingly, if you want to know how this works, just rent Thank You for Smoking.
Yeah.
When the science becomes overwhelming, make it about liberty.
Yeah.
Your freedom to smoke. The jobs that this will cost us. The American way of life.
And it's complicated.
It's very complicated. And then once that argument starts to teeter on the edge, say, well, it's too late now. Yeah. Too late now. No, it's changed already. Why? Yeah, maybe 20 years ago it would have been worse. But we're not going to – let's just say that you're right. It's too late to do anything about it. So let's just keep doing what we're doing. And – they learn from that. They learn that process of delay, delay, delay until it's too late, and they collect, you know, $1 million every step of the way. Mm-hmm. So back to how the purveyors of mechanized murder in this country learned from the tobacco industry to make sure that they are never held liable at the state or local level by buying off state and local legislatures.
Yep. Yeah. And then I want to dovetail that with the prayer shaming issue that came up yesterday. There's a very good series of tweets by Igor Volsky, who is with Think Progress. And he went through and found all of these, my thoughts and prayers go out to you from, you know, Carly Fiorina and
Paul Ryan
was one of them. A lot of these, Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. The NRA spent over $30 million in 2014 alone. Not $30 million over your lifetime, Drift Glass.
No.
$30 million in one election cycle.
But for each of those, our prayers are with them, thoughts are with. He documented how much money that particular
individual got. Exactly.
The NRA. Yeah.
And of course, the biggest one was Mitch McConnell, $922,000 mm-hmm. to his super PAC. So there are so many ways that one can come at this problem. Campaign finance reform, insurance reform, mm-hmm. requiring insurance on a gun owner would just transform everything.
Yeah.
If that's where you got to it. And I was talking with Junior Dude about this morning because he likes shooter games.
Yeah.
He's a 16-year-old, 17-year-old boy who likes shooter games, and he doesn't want to give up his guns. I said, yeah, but they're on a video game. That's different. Maybe it's not. Maybe it is. I struggle with that sometimes. But we talked about, you know, if you have an actual gun in your house, perhaps you should be required to have an insurance policy in case that gun hurts someone,
mm-hmm.
like you have for your car.
Exactly.
If I hit you with my car, I have insurance to pay the medical expenses and to pay to hopefully, you know, reimburse the person that I hurt with the car.
And it's mandatory.
I'm required to have that.
Well, you might remember it's before our time or before we certainly were doing this podcast. But back mm-hmm. in the old days when the auto industry fought tooth and nail against seatbelts, and airbag, not because they didn't work, but because they would give drivers the perception that the machine they were operating was somehow perhaps unsafe at some mm-hmm. point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And that would hurt their sales.
Mm-hmm.
Now airbags and seat belts and anti-lock brakes and mm-hmm. the safety of your family and crash dummy tests, et cetera, et cetera, are all marketing features of
cars
that tell you how incredibly safe this car is and how you can't possibly be hurt if you buy a Volvo.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah.
But the industry fought it because of money. Really simple.
Money.
They
it
thought
really
it would cut into their sales if they did this. And now it has become a feature. And you can do the same thing with guns. Yes. Make the expense of keeping the public safe from guns. Quit socializing that cost onto everyone else's back and make
it about money. Yep. Make it about money.
Gun owners pay for it.
And insurance companies then have an onus. Is that the right word?
Yeah. The onus falls on insurance
companies. The onus falls on insurance companies to say, oh, you've got a gun in your house. Where's the safe?
Yeah, where's the gun
safe? Where is it locked?
Yeah.
You know, the child that was killed this week because stepdad had a gun in the sofa.
Uh-huh.
You know, that doesn't happen if the insurance company inspects your house.
Oh, you had a gun you didn't tell us about it. Well, that's like smoking and you didn't tell us about it on your health.
Now you learn, now you don't have a policy anymore on your house.
Right. Your homeowner's insurance has been voided. Thank you very much. And you make it you bring those vicious market forces to bear on the side of safety. And then stand back and let the magic of the marketplace do what it does.
So I want to get into this prayer shaming thing because this is right up my alley.
It sure is.
And can I just – I told you this last night in bed. I hate Chris Saliza. I shouldn't say those things to you in bed.
We're having a romantic
Chris
evening.
I shouldn't have said Chris Saliza's name in the bedroom.
I had to go out and put out all 23 candles that I had lit and I swept up all the rose petals and I shot you a look that would just kill a squirrel. And our date night was over because you dropped the C word.
Right no.
Of our happy fun time.
No, I didn't.
No, you didn't.
No, you didn't.
None of that happened.
But I was reading in bed the Washington Post and...
Which you actually do, so, yes.
Yeah. So there has been a lot of blowback on Twitter to politicians who take money from the NRA and do nothing about gun violence.
Yeah.
Having the nerve to say, my thoughts and prayers are with the victims.
Yeah.
When you're bullshitting your way through it, and your prayers and thoughts are bullshit, and everybody knows it. And I'm going to call it that. Mm-hmm. Chris Saliza ends his column by saying, the effort to cast thoughts and prayers as trite reactions to horrendous events certainly represents a ratcheting up of the rhetoric.
Yeah. Like the racism. Calling a racist, mm-hmm. really doesn't help at all. Because it just adds vitriol to the mix. And it really is both sides who are to blame for this. Because, you know, naming and shaming people is certainly nothing Jesus would ever do.
Uh-huh.
But wait a minute. No, that's pretty much...
Yeah, no, totally woe unto the scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites.
Yeah, that was pretty
that's
much
exactly what he said.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he said. So Emma Green in The Atlantic made a point about this. And I don't think what she's saying is true, but I want to bring it up as a way of talking about this. She says, there's a clear claim being made here and one with an edge. Democrats care about doing something and taking action while Republicans waste time offering meaningless prayers. These two reactions, policymaking and praying, are portrayed as mutually exclusive, coming from totally contrasting worldviews. Uh-huh. Okay, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Elsewhere on Twitter, full-on prayer shaming set in. Anger about the shooting was turned not toward the perpetrator, but at those who offered their prayers. Okay, that is just all total bullshit.
Yeah, everything...
Everything she just said is bullshit.
Uh-huh.
But I think there is something in there that is a lesson for Democrats and a lesson for the larger way to win. I hate to use a Mark Halperin book title.
Don't
bring this up. But
first, Saliza, now Halperin.
I know. What's wrong with me?
Uh-huh.
The phrase Democrats care about doing something and taking action. This is the secret of Trump.
Yes.
Even though his prescriptions are racist bullshit.
Yeah. And insane.
And insane. The reason he has caught fire and the other candidates happen is his voters think he will do something. Mm-hmm. Build a wall. Uh-huh. That's something that they can point to in their little minds and say, oh, he wants to do something that's going to... you know, relieve my suffering as an unemployed manufacturing worker, right?
Well, it's not that he promises to do something. He promises to do something that will fit on a bumper sticker.
Yep, and it'll be terrific.
And that's really all you need to know.
And you don't have to get out of your Barca lounger or do anything. It's going to be terrific. Yeah. I'll take care of it.
And Democrats propose policies and legislation and regulation that involve paragraphs and pages and
complications
yep. and what yep. ifs and mm-hmm. and that was on full display this morning on the Stephanie Miller show briefly. Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb on talk radio, especially if it's a liberal talk radio, is if someone calls in and says they're an independent, they're a conservative.
Yep.
If someone calls in and says I listen to both sides, they're a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a small businessman and I rarely listen to this kind of radio.
Yeah,
I just,
right.
Bullshit.
Bullshit. Yes.
This guy was yapping on, and this is where I shut him off. I almost 9 times out of 10, I hear enough conservative crap in my life. I don't need to hear it through one of the very, very few liberal outlets I still have. Mm-hmm. But this guy was on about how it's really both sides. It's really both sides. It's the extreme rhetoric on both sides. And she's like, what the hell are you talking about? Do you agree guns are the problem? Well, maybe so, but... You know, and then it got to be, well, you just want to take everyone's gun away from everybody. The two alternatives are do nothing or confiscate everyone's guns and lock up anybody who wants to speak out against your liberal jackbootery. Yep. Those are the two alternatives which conservatives tell the pig people are their two choices. Yep. This is what liberals want. This is what liberals really want. They either want to confiscate everything or do nothing. Yep. Those are your two choices.
Those are your two choices. And, of course, doing nothing is better.
And,
yep.
And that's
yep.
because they listen to people like Rush Limbaugh, who takes a shit in their skull every day. And so they don't hear what they're trained like monkeys, like seals to hear is if you have a five-word explanation, that's good.
If you say,
look, if this is complicated and there are exceptions and there's stuff we can do, it's like my brain just shut off. I couldn't focus on anything past that sixth word.
Yep.
And this is where Democrats need to keep it simple and clear. And something you said yesterday, geez, you think Halperin and Saliza was...
Oh, yeah, this was awful. And this was at lunch, too. Again, I apologize.
Again, I threw up my meatloaf and stormed out. my wife said Democrats need to go full Reagan.
I did.
But in this sense, cheerful, upbeat, and sort of like blithely and smilingly dismissive of the stupid shit the GOP says.
Which is what Obama has done.
Yes. Absolutely. And he's good at it. He really is. Yep. But the whole idea that we're just going to sort of out-grim, out-anger, out-fear, out-shout these people is nonsense. Because that's what they are. That's what composes their personality. You said this yesterday. Common good sells better.
The common good.
It sells better.
What is the common good?
Yep. And it's better public policy, too. What is the common good? There's a I'm leaping around a little bit, but I would recommend Charlie Pierce did a very short, nice article about Mike Dukakis.
Oh.
Very brief. He's a guy he said he's written about more than any other politician. But Mike Dukakis is one of those people that really believes in the common good.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
mm-hmm.
truly does. And really, you know, walks the talk every day. And that's what Democrats, liberals believe. We believe in the common good. We believe that hope is better than fear and acting in our common interest is better than pitting people against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to hang on to. As dark as things get and as scary as they get, and you know next week there's going to be another tragedy. There's going to be another mass shooting. There's going to be another person mumbling about baby parts and blowing someone's head off.
And
all the machinery of the media is going to kick into exactly the same gears it always kicks into. We have to be better than that.
Yep.
We have to hang on to our vision of this country as a hopeful place where we keep our message simple. And, you know, we believe in clean air and clean water.
Yeah.
Good neighbors.
And safety for our children.
Exactly.
Safety for and good education for our children. These are simple, simple things. And if your priorities are $922,000 into your campaign coffers from the NRA, Mitch McConnell, and tax cuts for billionaires, Jeb Bush, and whatever crazy thing Ted Cruz is saying today, you're not in line with American values. And then you're done. 'Cause the average American isn't going to listen past that.
No. And, you know,
and that's unfortunate.
You know who got that, at least in terms of speaking style, was Kennedy.
Yeah.
You know, we all cherish our children's future. We all inhabit this planet. We all breathe the same air.
Yeah.
And just constantly, you know, to step right over this bullshit, this fear, divisive bullshit that is their stock and trade, and say, look, don't you care about the safety of America's children?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you care about the fact?
I know you do. I wouldn't even go, don't you? I wouldn't put it in a question.
You can't want your children to breathe poison.
Yeah, we all want our children to breathe clean air. Mm-hmm. Positive, positive, positive. And run it that way. I want to get back just to the Planned Parenthood shooting for one moment.
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of people, including Chris Hayes, decided that it was okay to use this news cycle opportunity to, in a sense, relitigate Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
Which I found really disturbing. And so I just wanted to read something that I wrote back long time ago.
Yeah.
I made a Photoshop of the Virgin Mary, and across her halo it says, I stand with Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
And the baby Jesus is on her lap, and this is a Renaissance painting, so baby Jesus is blonde.
Sorry.
Something else. Across the baby's halo it says, God is love. And then the angels are behind her, and on their halos, it says, trust women.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And they are looking with glowing admiration at the Virgin Mary, saying, trust women. Because
trust.
That's what God did. If you believe in the Christmas story,
mm-hmm.
God trusted an unwed teenager with his offspring.
If that's where you are.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to get a little verklempt, but because I do believe in this story. And so I put this up. We were doing a My Planned Parenthood blog swarm back in 2011, July of 2011. And I put this Photoshop up. And I wrote, before anyone goes all sacrilege on my ass, I believe in my heart of hearts that Mary is the mother and sister and companion to every frightened girl who enters a Planned Parenthood clinic for help.
Uh-huh.
And I know for a fact that not every pregnant woman who enters a Planned Parenthood clinic gets an abortion. Many of them go there so their babies will be born healthy. And in many parts of the country, it's the only place many women can go for prenatal care. Think about that, fundy mofos.
Yep.
And it did come up this week how it is not uncommon for anti-choice people to show up at a Planned Parenthood clinic to have it done.
Yep. Quietly.
And I tweeted this out to Chris Hayes that the exceptions are, as Nina Totenberg once said, rape, life of the mother, and me.
Yeah.
Or
yep.
my teenage daughter or my college age daughter.
Well, because you're a good person.
Yeah, well, they're a good person, and you don't understand my special snowflake situation.
Right.
I'm desperate here, right? And the number of good little Baptist girls who go to Planned Parenthood because they don't want Meemaw and Papa to know they're taking birth control.
Yeah.
And that is their right. So, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir now.
Literally,
but,
in a literal sense.
Literally.
Yeah.
Literally. But it goes back, I think, to the people who vote against Obamacare when they're getting Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
You know, it's, look, you have access to a safe legal abortion when it's your special snowflake situation, which is the same situation every other person who goes into this has. And then the responsibility of someone like Chris Hayes to really understand the court ruling on Roe v. Wade was about women and privacy.
Yep, period.
And the minute you make it about a fetus, which has no legal standing,
uh-huh.
you're outside the government decision that needs to be made about this issue, mm-hmm. which has been made and is established law. So that's where I am on that. And I really didn't like how those conversations went on MSNBC.
No.
That it was an opportunity to all of a sudden start relitigating a woman's right and whether where the fetus was and whether it was life or not. And, you know, I know Chris Hayes was raised Catholic and has these issues in the back of his mind, but he's got more of a responsibility to his listeners than that to make some sort of argument about, well, you know, there are a lot of pro-life people I've been taught by our listeners not to use that term. It's anti-choice. It's forced birth.
Right. Anti-choice.
Because pro-life, everyone is pro-life,
yeah.
Okay?
Uh-huh. It's anti-choice in the same way that right to work does not mean right to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, not everyone that doesn't like abortion would go and shoot up a Planned Parenthood clinic. Yeah, but you know what?
Uh-huh.
Somebody did.
That's right.
And they did because politicians lied.
Politicians made up. This is a subject.
You know, Political activists made up shit about an organization that helps people.
They dragged the ancient, you know, literally medieval slander of the blood libel, the murdering of Christian babies by the Jews to make their matzo balls.
Yeah.
They dragged that horrifying slander out of the sewers of, you know, medieval times. And turn it into a marketing campaign against Planned Parenthood. And Carly Fiorina and the rest of those filthy degenerates went right along with it because it works. Because they know their voters love that shit. They love hating people more than they love this country. And they gave them someone to hate. Planned Parenthood wasn't on the agenda 10 years ago. And now it's the literal manifestation of the Antichrist. They encourage women to get pregnant. They lure them in. They steal their children and chop them up and sell them for profit, because all of that on purpose. While Barack Obama looks over it all, cackles, and rubs his hands together in delight. That's how they view liberals.
It really is a medieval sense of the Jews. It's exactly the same kind of mythology of good and evil.
Once that got into their blood, I stopped having any desire to reason with them, because unless you shake yourself loose of this mesmerism, this hypnosis that the conservative media and conservative politicians and conservative billionaires have cast over you, that lets you believe these horrifyingly untrue things, and not just one, but one after another, Jade Helm, death panels, birtherism, Clinton shot Vince Foster. If you're the sort of person that has gone from one crackpot conspiracy theory to another, that's fine. You're free to do that. But the Republican Party has now been the place where those things are fertilized, cultivated, harvested as a matter of policy. There's no one left in the Republican Party who puts their hand up and says, this is insane. This is incredibly dangerous. This is really, really – you are dredging up ancient evil shit and you're flicking matches at it. And then you're surprised when someone goes into a Planned Parenthood clinic muttering baby parts and guns everyone in there down.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not surprised at all. That person is the primary person responsible and should go to jail. But building an ideology that says that this is all really true and harvesting votes and money from dredging up these ancient horrifying things and turning them into modern political vocabulary is unforgivable. I do not forgive anyone who's done this. You've moved beyond the pale. You've moved beyond civilization. And if you put these fuckers on television and give them a goddamn microphone, and then put someone next to them who said, but you know, liberals are bad too, you are going to burn in the same fucking pit of hell as those people will. Because you are enabling it and you're doing it for money. And that, again, is unforgivable. So
thank you, Drift Glass. We're going to end on that hell-raising.
You don't want to talk about Chicago at all?
I don't know what you want to do.
Well, here's what we should do. Number one, there's a wonderful article in Vox.
Yes.
Go read it.
Which is full Drift Glass.
It really is. Yeah. I was expecting royalties to come rolling in, but that is not going to happen. It
basically says that Trump proves that the media is irrelevant because of their both-siderism and their view from nowhere. They have made themselves irrelevant in the world of politics. And it's a very good article.
He has called their bluff.
Yep.
And they don't know what to do about it, because the only weapon they have is liberals are just as bad. Both sides do it. And Donald Trump is perfectly happy to say, fine, here's all the shit I'm going to unload on you. And when you call me out, I'm not going to back off an inch. So either you take sides against me, which is against your prime directive, because it has to be liberals are just as bad.
Yeah, your brain will explode.
Or you just sit there and let me do it, in which case I win either way.
Yeah.
And it has exposed the glaring failure, the rot right down to the bone of the mainstream media and how long it has been that they've been running this scam. And next week we'll talk about...
No, I want you to talk right now about Rahm Emanuel.
Really?
A lot of people want to hear about this.
All right.
Rahm Emanuel, Laquan McDonald. I was very proud of Junior Dude, our son.
Yeah.
Who during Thanksgiving dinner wanted all of us to bow our heads from the McDonald family, and he meant that sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell he really identified with this family losing their child in a very personal way, and that makes me very proud. Talk about Rahm Emanuel, you know, the chief of police that he quote-unquote fired or asked for the resignation. The media at first said he resigned.
Yeah.
And it was very quickly changed over to fired, asked to resign by the mayor.
Yeah.
And you knew that was, you know, the daily protocol being brought in.
Sure. Well,
you know, this is going to be my, this is how I'm going to deal with it, right?
And,
right.
And here's the thing. I've dropped this comment in a couple of places. Daly is gone, but Dalyism is forever in Chicago. Yeah. It is forever. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Bruce Rauner next week. But this week, Laquan McDonald, as everyone knows, is the young man who was murdered by police almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And that his murder by police was covered up repeatedly by the power structure of the Chicago Police Department, the attorney's office, everybody. Nothing was happening. Nothing was moving until an independent reporter dug into the story. And suddenly everything moved really fast. But Rahm Emanuel got the city council to approve a $5 million settlement with the family before it ever went to trial. The police, the audio I heard today, the audio on the dash cam is mysteriously missing. The cameras, the film from the Burger King, I believe, that was overlooking the scene is gone. No one knows where that went.
But there's film of them taking the Burger King video and deleting it. Yes.
So, yeah, and so this is a, that. This is a police cover up. This is a departmental cover up. This is a, and this is a cover up that, that my nose tells me goes right into Rahm Emanuel's office.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this teach us about Chicago? Well, once upon a time, there was a guy named Richard Daley, who was a very successful, very corrupt mayor of the city of Chicago. And there was a thing called the Hired Truck Program. And the Hired Truck Program was this program whereby the city essentially laundered tens of millions of dollars through Daley's family friends. His brother got, I have here, his brother got, Daley got at least $108,000, Richard Daley. His brother took in $47,000. There were mob ties to this thing. These were trucks that were sitting idle. This was just city tax money that was going to bribe and cheat and rip off the taxpayer year after year. And during the course of this process, they also discovered, quite by accident, a heroin ring being run out of the water department.
Yeah.
This was a system-wide case of institutional corruption. The Daley family and the Daley machine ripping off the taxpayers, bribing.
And they were armpit deep in it.
Yeah. Oh,
the
they were
family absolutely was armpit deep.
There was no way that they didn't know it was going. And everybody up to the mayor, there were an awful lot of people went to jail behind this. Awful lot of people got fired. So Rahm Emanuel finds himself in a very similar situation, a clear case of systemic corruption. The crime itself in this case was murder, but the cover-up, the deep systemic reaction to protect one of our own and fuck the truth, and whatever we have to do to keep this covered up is what we're going to keep. We're going to go right on doing because everybody's making out. Here's the difference. Richie Daley got a guy named Ron Huberman, plucked him out of the police department. The guy was a recruiting poster for Clean Cop. He looked like a clean cop. And put him in, made him chief of staff. You know, quintuple jumped him up the line and put him in charge and said, he's the chief of staff. He's going to clean this up. Whatever he wants to do is fine. He's got a gun. He's got a badge. He's now the chief of staff. He's now the second most powerful person in Chicago. He has my complete confidence. And Daley just walks off the scene. And Huberman fired a bunch of Daley's friends. And a bunch of other people got in trouble, too. But the mayor kept his job. And the mayor kept his job for a number of reasons that Rahm Emanuel cannot replicate or is not going to replicate. Number one, city council depended on Richie Daley for their jobs. He appointed half of them. They were dependent on him. And the hive mind of the city government is protect the queen, must protect the queen. So you can sacrifice any number of pawns and bishops to protect Daley. Nobody loves Rahm Emanuel. Nobody's willing to lay down their career to save his. He's an asshole. He's been an asshole since he was a congressman. He's a vicious, small-minded, narrow-gauge, corporatist dick who will shiv his own people in the side and dump them over the edge of the cliff faster than you can say, fuck you, which is his favorite term. He's the person who, you know, shoved Howard Dean out of the way and took credit for the Democratic victory in 2006, I believe, or 2006. Mm-hmm. He's an asshole, and he has bullied and clouted and muscled his way into the mayor's office. So there's nobody at city government who has any long-term institutional familial loyalty to Rahm Emanuel. Number two, the city's broke.
Yeah.
Daley got the hell out as soon as the budget started to crater. As soon as he couldn't get Olympic money into the city government so that they could prop up his programs and he could continue to solve his problems by throwing money at them. As soon as the money ran out, Richie Daley quit.
Yep.
So did Ron Huberman.
Because they're not stupid.
Because they're not stupid. Because what makes the city go is the clout of the mayor and money. And as soon as the mayor quit, as soon as Daley quit, all of the Daley dollars, all of the clout money, all of that's the coins that people had collected that Daley owed, turned into fairy gold. It doesn't count mm-hmm. anymore because he's not the mayor anymore. So Rahm Emanuel is an asshole that nobody likes. Daley was an asshole in a lot of ways who had built up over two generations enormous reservoirs of personal loyalty. Number two, Rahm Emanuel doesn't have money to throw around like Daley did. He can't bribe his way out of this one. And number three, his name ain't Daley.
Yeah.
And
you know who built the pyramids.
You know who built the pyramids? The mayor built the pyramids. Everybody knows that.
And the mythology of Chicago and the mayor and that he is untouchable isn't there anymore.
No.
Yep.
And here's the thing. The citizens of Chicago had a chance to vote for a reformer, and they blew it.
Yep.
And they chose the corporate guy because he had a shitload of money. Remember, Rahm Emanuel is in bed with the same people who are tight with Bruce Rauner. Rahm Emanuel is a corporatist through and through. He is not a Democrat in my sense of the word. He's a Chicago machine Democrat, but he didn't come up through the ranks and he doesn't have any loyalty from anybody. So it wouldn't shock me if he were driven from office. It wouldn't shock me if he's managed to stay on board either, but he is he has no goodwill and no fallback positions and nobody who's willing, again, to lay down their professional life to protect him. And that's deadly when you're playing municipal politics. Next week, Bruce Rauner.
All right. Thank you very much, Drift Glass. I love you very much. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Houdini, or Dini for short. We had a Dini a few weeks ago as well. This Dini is a beautiful black kitty with a white scarf and has a white spot on his chest. We figure that's probably an award, you know.
Yeah.
You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. And Drift Glass, we've got a couple very kind Christmas cards already with donations in them. And that's just so sweet. First of all, you're on the ball actually getting us a Christmas card the first week in December. We kind of, you know, roll our eyes at that because we're going to be behind. But
You've shamed us.
But thank you, guys. That is just so touching to get a Christmas card from a listener to the podcast, and the kids are amazed when that happens too. Wow, they sent you a Christmas card? Yeah.
We are the dorkiest, uncoolest people I know.
Yeah, well, we can't even. We hear that a lot. You guys, people care about you? We can't even. All right.
You know who people care about? Dan and Phil, not you people.
Dan and Phil, that's who they should care about, not you. Yeah. You're not Dan and Phil. We hear that a lot too, yes.
Yes, we do.
So feel free to write us. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, like, you know, a peppermint latte, buy one for us by sending us the cost of a peppermint latte. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We had a pretty good Cyber Monday, I will say that. And that helps us pay for our Christmas. So thank you. That doesn't cost you nothing. If you use the link at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, it sends you to Amazon. It doesn't matter if you have it log into an Amazon account from there. That's fine. A lot of people have been writing me and asking me, did you get my purchase and so forth? The way to tell, click on our link and look up above at the URL. If you see ProLeft20 in the URL, it's working. All right.
It's working, people.
And it,
you're soaking
in it. It's amazing. It is amazing that it works. A lot of people just can't believe. Is that all I have to do? Yes, it really does work.
Yep. So, and it doesn't, it adds not a nickel.
Nope. Doesn't add anything to the purchase price at all. And they give us a single digit percentage of the purchase that you make. And it doesn't cost you anything. Now we get, like, if somebody signs up for Audible from our link, we get $5, you know, so that's a big hefty amount, you know, usually for us. But, you know, for most things, if you buy a book, we get 6% of the price or 4% or something like that. I mean, it depends on the item. But it adds up. What I want to say, if over the course of a weekend, 100 people order, you know, we get some money out of that. And we really appreciate it.
You know how they built Wrigley Field, Blue Gal?
Amazon donations.
Chewing gum money.
That's right. Wrigley. Yeah. Yeah, people buying packets of gum. Yes. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a financial contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. I know I've said this before, but people that sign up and give us $5 a month, those are the people that pay our electric bill.
Yeah.
So straight up, even money, we make enough from the $5 contributions to pay our electric bill.
Keep
and we got a very moving, you know, usually I don't open all of the charitable asks that I get in the mail at this time of year. But I do open the Doctors Without Borders ones.
Yeah.
And you and I looked at that one and I said, okay, $5. And because it's hard to send money. Mm-hmm. It's hard to part with money. We're not, you're not working full time.
Nope.
And we are grateful at the end of every month when we can pay our bills. Mm-hmm. But when we believe in something and something means something to us, $5 is what we can part with. So we do that.
And we pass
that. And it does make a difference.
It does.
So just want to say that.
So we waste your money on
doctors. No, we don't. On Doctors Without Borders.
And
$5. Yeah. And electricity. Well, and the thing is, while we're talking about this, a couple of people have asked, is it 1% year round or is it 1% every week or what is it? It's 1%. We average 5,000 listeners a week.
Yeah.
And the amount of listeners that we hear from with money every month is about 1% of that. And that's typical.
Yeah.
If you get a mailing from somebody asking for money, 1 to 2% of the people that get that envelope will actually send money back. That's a normal response.
Now, another way for us to, if listeners would like to increase, you can always grow the pie. Mm-hmm. So here's the thing. Mm-hmm. We average 5,000 listeners, sometimes gets up around 8,000, which is very exciting. But if we were getting listened to by 50,000 people, or 80,000,
even 12,000. Yeah,
The proportional amount of people who kick in a buck here or a buck there would go up proportionally, and that would certainly help out a lot. I don't know how to do that because I don't know how to do that. It's not one of my skill sets. But if you pass this along, we have met people who are sort of underground listeners is not quite right.
Yes.
People who have heard of us and then get recommended and then they go, wow. And they sort of binge listen to a bunch of old episodes. And
yes,
that's great. We think what we do is of value, and we hear back from enough of you that we get that confirmed every week.
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
You know, what you do, the regularity with which you do it, the vocabulary you provide, the stuff you focus on, and the way you focus on it is different than almost anybody else.
Mm-hmm,
If we could double our listenership in a way that keeps it us without doing ads or anything like that, keeps it organic, keeps it you and me.
We're not marketing people. I mean, we're just not. And you can tell by the way we're talking about this that we're not marketing people.
And we're going to keep saying fuck, so that's just going to keep.
Yeah, just too bad.
But every time we get a new listener, it increases our chances of being able to afford to keep doing this a lot longer.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
Anyway,
that's
my little editorial of the day.
There you go. Hey, please rate our show on iTunes or give us a thumbs up on Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. Hey, Drift Class, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, you know, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties have renamed their litter box the USS Ted Cruz.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
The Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Love Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
All right, Science Fiction University, we have something that I'm going to read off to you from quizup.net.
I didn't know Dogface Herman had his own company.
No, he could, oh. But we're actually using something else this week off the internet.
Oh, I see. An internet
Dogface Herman will be back, trust me.
Yes.
But I got 10 questions for you, and some of them are kind of tough, so
okay.
I hope you're ready.
All right, hit me.
All right. This first one is a year question. I'll give you plus or minus 4 years, all right, on the answer.
All right.
In what year did Jules Verne publish his classic novel, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
That's a tough one. Before H.G. Wells. 1881? 90? Something like that?
1870.
1870?
I know.
God damn those French.
Number two. Neal Stephenson's 1999 novel, Cryptonomicon, contains instructions on how to encrypt secret messages using what everyday object?
Oh, crap. The only thing I think of is a book code where you both have a copy of the same book and you both assign values to words or mention pages and back and forth. But
actually, it's a deck of cards.
Oh, well, that makes sense. That everybody would have that.
Yep. All right. I know this one you're going to get. We know that Foundation is the work of prolific science fiction author Isaac Asimov.
Yes, we do. We absolutely do know that.
What is the Foundation? What is that?
Oh, that's such a broad and philosophical question.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Hard to
answer it in. You have 30 seconds to answer this question.
Oh, I can't do it in 30 seconds, but I can do it in over the course of a 16-week lecture series.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Let's compromise and say that the Foundation was set up as a ruse. It's set up as a joke, actually.
Oh.
Not a joke, but a cover.
A trick.
It was a tricksy trick that actually turned out to be true because the Foundation trilogy does contain quotes from the Encyclopedia Galactica.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to send off a bunch of scientists and other useful people to a planet far, 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 far away from the core of the Galactic Empire. Because it was going to collapse. The Galactic Empire was in full retreat. Nobody noticed it. And the idea was that there's nothing you can do to stop the fall of the empire. There'll be a Dark Ages that lasts, I think it was like 30,000 years. Some horribly long period. Barbarism would ensue. But the idea was to stash away a tiny group of people who would, at the right place, at the right time, with the right materials, under the right political circumstances, be able to grow a society called the Foundation, which would in turn become shorten the period of barbarism down to 1,000 years.
Can I ask you a question about this, Driftglass?
Sure.
Did they ever make a Foundation trilogy movie?
I don't think so.
It doesn't surprise me because it seems really complicated.
Well,
it's intellectual rather than action hero-ish.
Well, the idea of the vast sweeping galactic empire.
Mm-hmm.
That is collapsing.
Yeah, well, that's
basically Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah,
it has been the ideas in the Foundation trilogy have been used over and over and over again. And Asimov was pretty clear. I think he used the rise and fall of the Roman Empire as his source material. But it really was. It's a very interesting science fiction novel because it has atomics and it has blasters and it has faster than light drive and it has all those things. But its heroes are really political and economic.
Mm-hmm.
And they are put in a specific place where they, by a series of choices that history forces on them, it forces them to become a major political power, an economic power, a religious power. As their influence begins to grow, they have to cloak the science they're developing in magical terms.
You know what this needs? A little sex.
It does. And Asimov was terrible at writing. Terrible.
I was going to say, this is not a chick novel.
No. Now, in fact, you can take all the... somebody pointed out to me years ago, you can take all the gender references out of an Asimov novel and never know which one's which.
Wow.
Because he does... But for what it is, a great space opera about the rise and fall of a galactic empire. It's really good. And it's... It moves along, you know, for a talky, for a chatty novel, it moves along pretty quick.
Number four, what is the average height in feet and inches of a hobbit? And oh, don't geez. Tell me that's not science fiction.
Well, feet and inches are certainly science fiction. I'm guessing 3.5 feet, half of 7 feet, 3.5 feet.
You're correct. You're exactly right. You're 3 feet, 6 inches. Exactly right. Okay. Cool. I don't know how you did that.
But. I just figured it was 3 foot something.
Yeah. All right.
You got to add something. And 3 foot two would be silly, and 3 foot eight would be hard to remember.
That's kind of taller than you would think they'd be, too. All right.
Well, half a Gandalf, let's say.
Number five. Mm-hmm. The title of the 1975 science fiction novel, The Mote in God's Eye, Ooh. Is a reference to a quote from where?
From the Bible.
Yeah, it's from the Bible. The Mote in your... friend's eye, or the mote in your neighbor's eye, and the beam in your eye. Correct.
Yeah. The beam is a block of wood.
Right.
So before you start bitching about what they're doing.
Right. A speck of wood in your neighbor's eye, you're complaining about that, and then, but you've got a big block of wood in your eye. So, all right. What does the mote in God's eye refer to?
Oh, the mote in God's eye is the a planet that is discovered by the, what was it, Co-Dominium. Ah, the Co-Dominium. I can't remember. I believe I remember that. Which is the space navy of the Earth Federation, whatever the hell it is. A galactic empire, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's a little fleck in the corner of a nebula that
right.
looks from a particular angle like a little fleck in someone's eye. That's actually a planet that has a species on it that is incredibly inventive and incredibly smart and incredibly adaptive, but have a disastrous reproductive cycle that if it ever got loose, if it ever got a hold of Earthlings faster than light technology or developed it on their own, would ruin everything.
Okay.
So it's a first encounter novel with a species that is in many ways very superior to human beings. That's trying to hide its terrible secret so they can, get on our good side and get the hell out of its tiny solar system.
I see. But if it does that, then it will, it's bad. Like kudzu. It will just consume everything. Okay.
Everything. Bad thing. Bad. Many bad things would happen.
What science fiction icons attempt to write an issue of Adventures of Superman collided with his incendiary anti-gay views?
Oh, man. There are a lot of assholes in science fiction. It would have to be recent because writing a gay Superman theme in the 50s or 60s would not have flown at all. I don't know. I can think of a long list of authors that I would cringe to learn if it was them. If it turned out to be Harlan Ellison,
no.
It would break my heart.
No,
but
it's not.
No.
It is Orson Scott Card.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
He's an asshole.
All right.
He's a right-wing asshole. Sorry, he writes a good book, but Jesus, he's got some fucked up.
Number seven. Huh? Ray Bradbury's The Illustrated Man was turned into a movie in 1969.
Ooh.
Starring which Oscar-winning actor? Who starred in The Illustrated Man?
I would like it to be Ernest Borgnine because that would just be awesome.
Mm-hmm, no.
But it's, as I recall, Rod Steiger.
That's right. It's Rod Steiger. All right.
Now, another Ray Bradbury novel, which mm-hmm. is a collection of vignettes, The Martian Chronicles, was mm-hmm. turned into a made-for-TV special.
I remember that, actually.
70s or 80s, starring Rock Hudson, as I recall.
Rock Hudson.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Number eight. In the final chapter of A Clockwork Orange, the chapter which was omitted from U.S. publication and from the movie.
Huh?
What happens to Alex?
As I recall, he puts on a wig and becomes Margaret Thatcher.
Prime Minister of England.
Yes.
Yes.
Hello.
No. No, you're wrong.
His views are pretty much directly translatable
wrong.
To the poor and other people who
wrong.
Get in the way. No? Wrong? Oh.
Wrong.
Right. Well.
He turns his back on violence.
Oh. Equally improbable.
So. Yes. All right. Number 9 is a multiple choice.
You know how I love those.
Which of these did not appear in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series?
All right.
A Bob Dylan lyric.
Huh?
B, a detective named Dirk Gently.
Uh-huh.
C, a teleporter. Or D, the Galactic Empire.
Well, teleporter empire out. And Douglas Adams wrote a series called the Dirk Gently Holistic Detective Agency.
Correct, correct. He did write that. That's true.
And I'm thinking there might have been a crossover character from this one, so I'm going to go. I'm going to default to the Dylan lyric and say Dylan.
No, it's Dirk Gently. The mice at the end want to know how many roads did a man walk down.
7, exactly 7.
42, oh, actually, right?
That's a bit from The Simpsons too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, trying to explain to Homer what a rhetorical question is.
Mm-hmm.
Rhetorical, eh? Like, how many? 7. No.
All right. Last one. Who emigrated to the United States from Luxembourg, founded Amazing Stories, and became a pioneer in science fiction?
Oh, shit. I should know this. I really should know this. I really do know this, but... John, the only thing I can think of is John Campbell, and I'm pretty sure that's not right.
It's Hugo Gernsback.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hugo, for whom the Nebula Award is.
It's not the Nebula.
The Hugo Award is named for Hugo.
The Hugo Award is named after Hugo. Correct.
Yeah. And who wrote, I don't recall. These were the days, as I recall from, I wasn't alive then, but sort of backwards reading and references where. You know, melting ice caps with microwave energy was considered science fiction.
Yeah.
A can that will open by itself. This is a miracle. And that was the story. You know, there was no other plot than the gadget and how cool the gadget was. So until Robert Heinlein came along and started just dropping in references to technology as if that was just commonplace because dwelling on the gadgetry was boring and the story was the important part. That's what science fiction really changed. Turned into a form of literature.
Yes. All right. Speaking of literature, I'm going to ask you this last question.
Okay.
Which Hitchhiker's book did Douglas Adams consider his best of those 5 books?
Well, he's dead.
True.
So he's not around to tell me I'm wrong. Like
I'm just around to tell you you're wrong.
He would call me constantly and explain how
he would.
Wrong. You don't understand my work at all. I'm sorry. I don't even know you.
Uh-huh.
Jesus. So long and thanks for all the fish.
No, it's Restaurant at the End of the Universe is the one that is his personal favorite. Was his personal favorite. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you. You watched
the end of the mid-season finale.
The mid-season finale. The exciting mid-season finale.
The exciting mid-season finale of Walking Dead. So, spoiler alert to anybody who hadn't seen that yet. You watched it with the girls because they now have a party on the king-size bed every Sunday night. I don't know what you're going to do this Sunday.
I'll tell them ghost stories.
Or yeah, something.
We'll watch Jennifer Jones.
Something.
Yeah. Or
Jennifer
Hyde
Jones
Castle.
Might be a little bit. Both of those might be a little bit grown up for 11 and 13.
Okay, Shamlet.
Man in the High Castle is violent. The episode 3 or whatever one, the one we just watched, was really. Uh-huh. I mean, I know Nazis and the Japanese tortured and imprisoned people. We get that, but you know, watching torture scenes of Japanese prison camp, prison pictures is not my idea of good entertainment for them.
Okay. I will refrain from saying, you mean zombies eating people is...
Yeah, no, I know. But at least you can sort of say...
It's makeup. It's pure fiction. It is absolutely pure. It's not that close to the bone.
Yeah.
I will say that the greatest achievement of this season of The Walking Dead is I now have corrupted utterly the girls so that they, if they're very good, they can watch The Walking Dead.
Except I should also say that the youngest child, who is a math whiz and is always talking about she's going to go into math and make a lot of money and so forth, has all of a sudden fallen in love with Holocaust diaries.
Yeah.
And wants to learn everything she can about World War II and the Holocaust and the camps and the, and she started with Anne Frank and she just really wants to read a lot about this and the passionate stories of survivors and so forth. And it's fascinating to watch that so she's really interested in that era of history. And so.
Yeah, we had a good chat about it, she and I.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was,
you did.
The distinction between enjoying the literature and enjoying the content.
Yeah.
The subject. Right, the subject is horrible and tragic.
Right.
But the quality of the writing is what makes it good or bad, readable or unreadable, or art. And she really does understand the difference between the quality of the literature and the tragedy of the content, which
She does. She absolutely does.
But yeah, it's fun watching them transition almost overnight sometimes from chapter books to complicated stories of and from one subject to the other, and they're good at what they transition to. So she's still a math whiz, but now she's interested in history.
Right.
So, but spoiler alerts, not much to speak of. It's mid-season. a main character we thought was dead ain't dead. The safe haven is in trouble. And we have been introduced by proxy, not directly, but by proxy, to the main villain.
Okay.
We didn't see him. The actor who is going to play that villain has been cast already and has already set up his own Twitter account. And his
That character has a Twitter account. He said, read the books.
Yeah. But
there you go.
It was a good place. There were, as you would expect... everything was once again tossed up in the air, and where you presumed you were safe is no longer safe, and the bad guys you've been battling, you learn, are not the worst of the bad guys yet to come.
Yeah,
I think that's fair to say.
I think it's interesting the history of how serialized drama moved from daytime to nighttime.
Oh yeah,
and how that. You know, transition may be connected to how people work.
Absolutely right. And I think you're absolutely
right about that. And which members of the family work during the day, and that drama. I mean, the what's going to happen next dramas of daytime television are so clearly the emotions are so clearly reflected in shows like The Walking Dead. You know.
Well, and there are
Glenn, but what about his pregnant wife? What's going to happen to her?
What of the children? When studying literature, as I did, at a big school in the downtown Chicago area, one of the things we had to read were novels of the past, like Vanity Fair, which I found interesting and boring and interesting, but it was all the heightened moments. And all the – oh, my goodness. Yeah, and it was Potboiler. It was – there were a lot of these very large books that are studied in literature classes are built for, you know, families to read during the winter.
Yeah.
Together as a story. Mm-hmm. And it is – there is not that much difference. I mean, I will still always take a television show or a movie usually. Because it really is absolutely under your control. You know, it's limited by your imagination, and you can turn it off and on, and you can go back and forward all you want, and it costs – there's zero power consumption except for the light.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that if you're going to have the – if you're going to have drama in your family, if you're going to actually tell stories, have stories, read, you know, literature, introduce your family to stories, they had to be really gotten, they had to get much, much better to qualify. You know, their sitcoms are just what they are. Even Star Trek, which was a very fine attempt at science fiction early on, you knew nobody was going to die.
Right. No, none of the main characters.
None of the characters are going to die. There's no threat. There's no peril. There's no real peril.
Just the red shirt.
Exactly. And you knew who that was going to be in the first 3 minutes.
Because he had a red shirt on. Yes.
But there are, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of good writers out there, and they have been looking for an outlet, a way to tell their stories for a really long time. And now is a really good time for that thing. In fact, there's the Grantland, the RIP Grantland, a very fine site called Grantland, had a podcast that's now been resurrected with Andy Greenwald and Chris Ryan about essentially there's too much.
Yeah.
There are amazing pieces of drama being created at such a pace that you no longer have the four or five that everyone knows about.
It's our generation doing that too.
It really is. Yeah. And that's impressive as hell. I mean, you know, the shit will disappear. History will grind it away. And I'm sure 20 years from now, our kids will be stunned that their kids are watching, you know, SpongeBob SquarePants with rapt attention the same way they watch sometimes, I don't know, who's the boss?
Yeah, yeah.
And go, Jesus, really? That thing won't die? That's just awful. But there are a lot of good writers doing a lot of good work in the medium of television. And
that's something to be grateful for.
It is. And you know, this reminds me of back when science fiction was a shameful bastard media. You know, it's the thing you hid in your larger book. You didn't open a comic book up in class or on the train. You hid it behind something, you know, large and respectable. But now science fiction is respectable, and drama is respectable and can hold its own against pretty much any other genre. So that's remarkable and interesting, and I'm glad to be around for it.
Right. Thank you. We'll be back again next week with more Science Fiction University. I love you, Driftglass.
I love you, Blue Gal. Bye.
I'll see you later. Bye.